All right, welcome to our Roughing the Passer podcast every Monday. I'm Pete Prisco, joined by Brady Quinn, and we finally worked it out where Pat Kerwin has joined us. What's up, Pat? How are you?
I would love to be with you guys doing this podcast. This is a chance to take the gloves off, Pete, do a little punching.
I think, well, you know, you love the name of the podcast, right? Roughing the Passer. It fits, doesn't it?
It's an incomplete name. It's Roughing Up the Passers is who you are.
Thank God you're here, by the way, Pat, because now you can provide a little bit more common sense to these conversations and see if maybe you can talk some sense into Pete.
Well, now he's going to be 2-on-1. You're going to gang up on me. I don't like that.
Pete, you spent your whole life being ganged up 2-on-1. You're a natural for that.
No, I was the kind of guy that always found another guy and we won 2-on-1. That's how you know how that
you're
goes.
In trouble here, big boy.
Hey, Pat, let's take a look back as we do every week in the NFL on Monday. And a lot, you know, this weekend, the past games were supposed to be not so good. You know, it wasn't great matchups. And when you looked at it, there actually ended up being a couple good games. I mean, let's start with San Diego. San Diego and Cleveland. That was a really good game. And then you had a guy trying to kick a field goal to win it, and Cleveland's offside. Who gets the blame for that? Is it the player or is it the coach?
The players are on the field, and Brady knows this. There's not one time any special team coach ever didn't go over, you know, hold your water, understand what to do, know the snap count. At the end of the day, and play, to me, all special teams are a disaster for the whole month of September and into early October. You got too many replacement guys in there, too many rookies in there. You go look at the punt coverage units, they're terrible right now. And so it doesn't surprise me we have what I call mental errors that turn into physical errors. I'm not blaming the coach. Now, if it keeps happening, they'll fire the coach. You can't fire the players anymore. They'll fire the coach, but they ought to be realizing it's the players' fault.
Now, what do you mean you can't fire the players? You could cut them. We're seeing that all the time, man.
Yeah, if you got that good old cap security, you don't get cut.
Well, that player doesn't.
And that was Tremont Williams, who actually has some security.
That was a younger player.
No, it was Tremont Williams was the guy. So, but I know Pat was going to defend the coaches. I knew that was inevitable, and I knew Brady was going to defend the players.
Hold on. I'm not defending the players. That was a bonehead play.
Right. Who's it on then?
It's on the player. 100%. 100%. You got to take accountability. One, the way the kickers have been kicking right now. You almost don't even have to rush. You got a 50-50 shot. These guys aren't going to make the kicks the way they're missing PATs and everything else. So if I'm rushing a kicker or trying to block it, the last thing I'm doing is trying to get a jump on the snap count. I'm just watching the ball. Once it's snapped, I'm trying to go in and doing my job. But for the most part, these kickers are going to miss it on their own.
Particularly in that situation, when you move it five more yards, and it's a 39-yarder to win it anyways. It made no sense. And, Pat, you gave the coaches a pass. I don't. I never give coaches a pass. Look, if there's a mistake made on the field like that, a mental mistake, which is exactly what it is, that's on the coach. You haven't drilled it into that guy hard enough because he jumped off sides in a key situation. Blame the damn coach, please.
Yeah, you did, and you can, but I can't stop you, but I won't. On things like that, it's, as Brady called it, a bonehead play. You know, there's a lot of pressure right now on the kickers, a lot of pressure. And consequently, I think there's a lot of pressure on the blocking units as well because – whether it's the snapper, the holder, the kicker, and what went on in Pittsburgh Thursday night, a lot of people think the holder had a lot to do with it. So I think the pressure that has become part of the extra point has really spilled over into kicking field goals as well.
You know what the kickers are today on a Monday? The overreaction of overreactions. And I say that because just for the sake of the argument, to say that the kickers haven't been that bad, this was only like the second most field goals missed since 2010. One weekend, about, I think, in the 90s at one point, you had 35 field goals missed. It wasn't even close to that. The top six of the top 10 active kickers in field goal accuracy top 10 kickers in field goal accuracy are active now. 14 of the top 40 are active now. The kickers are better than they've ever been. This is overreaction.
No, you're talking about for the top half of the league, Pete. I mean, Pat, I don't know where you are on all this, but look, I think what this rule has done is it's exposed the guys who aren't very good kickers, and it's really heightened or highlighted the guys who are some of the best kickers in the league because their accuracy continues to be proven week after week, and the guys who are bad, they're out. They're getting cut. And it's a bit surprising, but Pat, I know we talked about this earlier. To me, changing the PAT now, it has put more pressure on kickers because it's actually made it into a legitimate play, and it's harder. So now they don't necessarily see that ball go through the uprights quite as easily as, per se, they did before, where it was more of a confidence builder. Kind of like you're playing basketball, you have a bad shooting night, you get to the free throw line, you watch it go through the hoop, all of a sudden you have all that much more confidence in your abilities seeing it go through their uprights as the old PAT versus what we're at right now.
Brady, I'm on your side on this one, and a couple things. For five teams in this league to go into this season with rookie kickers, five teams that had kickers that never kicked anything in the NFL before, that's a big risk, number one. Number two, I do think your whole point about getting a little comfort zone, nothing better for a quarterback than throw a bubble screen on the first pass, get a completion, get rolling. These guys used to run out there and kick the extra point after the first touchdown, and they feel good about themselves. Now they're sweating what's going to go on. So I do think there's a lot more pressure on it. We haven't even had the bad weather yet. Wait till that starts.
Hey, guys, you make $2 million, whatever dollars the good kickers make a year, to go kick the ball between the uprights and stand around a practice for 2.5 hours, you know, twiddling your thumbs. Give me that money. I'll do it. Are you kidding me?
No,
pressure?
You know
go make the damn kick.
And we're going to raise the money to see if you can do it.
I hate special teams as it is. Everybody always says it's a third of the game. No, it's not. It's about 14.5% of the game, and now it's a little more because the extra point actually matters some, but come on. Go make your damn kick. There's a million kickers. The kicking now is so much better. So much better than it's ever been.
You can't even hit the snapper, so it should be perfect.
Why isn't it then?
That's the thing. It's surprising to me, too, because if you think about it, college kickers have to deal with wider hashes, so the angles aren't necessarily playing to their advantage. Now you're in the NFL, you have closer hashes. You'd think that would actually help them a little bit. I mean, look, for example, Kyle Brenza got released by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers this week, and he was the all-time leading kicker in Notre Dame's history, one of the most accurate kickers in the NCAA during his time. And he transitions to the NFL and just doesn't have quite as much success right away. And it's a bit shocking. I mean, I can't even draw any conclusions.
And Pat will remember this. Remember Steve Little, Pat? He was going to be the greatest kicker in the world when they drafted him coming out of Arkansas that one year. The Cardinals did, and it never translated. I mean, some guys it works, and some guys it doesn't.
Well, I think why we're talking about it is because a number of games ended with a missed field goal or sent it to overtime for a loss. So the moments that were on television for the viewers were critical moments. It wasn't a field goal in the middle of the game. I missed a 42-yarder, and they come down and they score a series later. There were some moments this past weekend that were game changers, and that's why I think we're talking about it.
Isn't that what this is all about, too, in the end? I mean, if this happened 20 years ago, 15 years ago, it didn't have Twitter and Facebook and everything else where everybody can just pile on and make it a bigger story than what it is. And so that's why I think now when they miss like that in key situations, because everybody saw Jacksonville's kicker miss too. Everybody saw the Saints doink it off the upright last night. I mean, I think that, you know, the Steelers on Thursday night. So doesn't that all enhance it? It enhances it, right?
Yeah, as Ron Wolf used to say, don't take the foot out of football, but there it is, and it can lose you games. You know, we're seeing, what do you have, three kickers already fired? I think it's three. And so when you see these rookie kickers getting dumped, it doesn't surprise me. Most kickers bounce around the league, play for five or six teams. But I found it amazing, the kicker got fired in Houston. He missed two extra points. The next day, he was in Pittsburgh for a workout. That's how lean the group is. So your point, Pete, about there's a million kickers, apparently there aren't, because that guy got a tryout the next day.
Well, and the kid in Jacksonville, Jason Myers, he didn't even win the kicking job in the Arena League. He was a backup kicker in the Arena League. But he's got a big leg. You know what I noticed about him? And this is what they're going to have to get over. Eventually, you either get over it or you don't. You go out there, even with the big leg, and you make the kick. He had this look on his face like, oh, my God, what am I doing here? And that's the unknown question with these guys. Sometimes you get a kicker, you don't know who he is, and he comes in and he becomes this great kicker. Right? The Ravens have a really good kicker in Tucker. They didn't know how good he was. He became a good kicker.
Look at Cairo Santos for the Kansas City Chiefs. He was responsible for all the points this past weekend.
Yeah, so, he had seven field goals.
Yeah, I mean, look, the end result is, I think we're seeing exactly what everyone wanted out of the PAT. It's brought the kicking game to light. It's actually made the PAT now a competitive play. It's having an effect on the game, which you know, right or wrong, I think there's a couple coaches have come out and said, you know, the thing that stinks about it is kickers have gotten so good at kicking for the most part that they had to change the rule just to take a little, to change the game and take it away from them. Right now we've got to put an asterisk next to some of the kicking stats where it happened before the PAT rule. And it's kind of changed the way we look at things now. But look, cause and effect, right? That's exactly what the NFL wanted. That's exactly what, you know, fans and everyone wanted, and they got it.
All right, we spent way, way, way too much time talking about kickers and special teams because, you know, this is a football podcast, you know, so we don't really want to talk about that stuff on here.
Stop with that.
What's that, Pat?
Kicking is part of it. Hey,
kick the ball out of bounds. What the hell? Punt the ball out of bounds. Yeah, kick the ball into the crowd and punt the ball out of bounds and play football. Line them up and play. That's my theory. But talking about real football, get back to that again. Rex Ryan and Chip Kelly, they are two of the anointed sons in the National Football League, okay? Two of them. Rex has been 26-38 the last four seasons, and now he's 2-2 in Buffalo. Is Rex Ryan overrated, Pat? Brady?
Well, overrated compared to what? You know, Bill Belichick? Yeah, but he's in the middle of a process of getting this team moving along. They laid an egg this week. The week before, if you asked me that question a week ago today, I would have said, this guy's got it right. He's figured it out. So he's what you call him. He's an up-and-down guy. But he promotes himself, so he deserves this line of criticism. The other guy, I don't think Chip Kelly promotes himself. I think the fascination with Chip Kelly led to this investigation by the media, and consequently, some tried to create this mystic, if you will, a guy that was changing the game with this vision, and that's not the case. We all know the game is played differently, and he's coming back to earth in my mind.
I think in the case of Rex Ryan, look, he kind of went through a bit of a turbulent time there with the Jets. If we would have been talking about Rex Ryan at the beginning of his time with the Jets, you would have been sitting there saying, well, he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. When you look at the AFC Championships games he got to with Mark Sanchez early on in his career in a very dominant defense, but then all of a sudden you start to have quarterback problems. There starts being turnover on the roster, turnover on the coaching staff, and now it's led him to the Buffalo Bills, where he's got a ton of talent, but we'll see what he's capable of doing with this team, and if he can actually dethrone the Super Bowl champion, the reigning AFC East champion, New England Patriots, for quite some time. On the flip side, Chip Kelly, look, he's 21-15 currently. That's his win record.
Zero playoff wins.
I'm with you, Pete, but he's 2 years into it. He's still trying to build, I guess you'd say, a culture there in Philadelphia. We've seen that with the way he's changed the roster and the things he's done, getting power away and taking control of the roster over who is it, Howie Roseman?
Yeah.
In the offseason. So he's still trying to, I think, kind of implement his culture, his strategy. And look, he's either going to be standing out next to the garbage cans at one point because of it, or he's going to be holding the Lombardi Trophy. And then that's what I think most coaches would like to do. It's just too early on to tell what he's capable
of. Pat, I want to ask you this. Is the job too big for one man? Because I believe it is, and I watched that in Jacksonville. Tom Coughlin was a great coach and a not-so-good front office guy, and I think Chip Kelly might be being undone. Chip Kelly, the coach, might be being undone by Chip Kelly, the general manager.
A couple things. It can be too big for the average guy, but it's not too big for Belichick. It's not too big for Pete Carroll. And what those guys do is they get incredible support around them, and they give enough power away that everyone feels good about themselves, and they work really hard. But ultimately, every player in New England, every player out in Seattle knows that the guy in front of the room at the Wednesday morning meeting is the guy in charge.
Well, they you know Seattle very well.
So I think that's an important piece that you better have. Don't like when the guy upstairs in the ivory tower is the one the players think control all the strings.
Well, you know the Seattle situation very well. Is Schneider calling the shots or is Pete calling the shots?
Pete's in charge. Pete hired John.
Right, but who made? Okay,
Smith,
so how's that play out? Let's just say through the draft, John Schneider is the guy who goes through the whole process and decides who they're going to pick, but then Pete jumps in and makes the pick.
Pete basically has educated John as to what he's looking for. And then John has done an incredible job of going out and finding those guys. But so, how many GMs do you think would draft Russell Wilson on their own? The NFL is a world of probabilities. Oh, he's not 6'4". Oh, blah, blah, blah. Pete basically has as much power as he wants. He's in charge of everything. But he doesn't use it that way. And I know that Bill Belichick, who I worked with in a draft room, that guy works harder on personnel than any coach I've ever been around. And I was with both of them. But he has Nick Cesario, and Nick has a lot to say to him. And he had Scott Pioli. If you're going to be the guy in charge without this GM in charge type, then you have to have good people under you. But I'm telling you, I've observed it for so long. And this is to Brady. The players, if the players think the head coach is the man in charge, they see him a whole lot different than if they think he's just a puppet for the front office.
Yeah, 100%. And a lot of those conversations you have with your head coach are different when things aren't going quite as well in the field or if you're having issues with stuff. Because when he's the head guy and he's the guy who's actually calling the shots, now those conversations become real. As opposed to you going in there and talking to your head coach about some of the issues you're having, they're kind of falling on deaf ears, basically because he doesn't have a lot of pull, he doesn't have a lot of say.
Yeah, and that brings me to the news of the day. It's talking about a coach who didn't appear to have a lot of pull and a lot of clout with his locker room, Joe Philbin, the head coach of the Miami Dolphins, fired, replaced by Dan Campbell. Brady, this isn't a real shock.
I was there last year during training camp.
What did you think of him?
I think he was a
honest.
I wasn't there long enough to give him, I don't know. I guess I had to have much of a say. I mean, my initial impressions was he was a nice guy.
Right.
I think the type of program and the setup he had for training camp was, towards the side of being more innovative than, back being old school and something that hasn't worked. I think as far as he ran things, he did his best to allow his players the chance to perform. But you could already tell then that there were gripes amongst players.
That's what I wanted to get to. How long were you there? Like a couple weeks?
I was there for like the 3 weeks.
You talked to players.
Yeah.
Did they not like Joe Philbin?
They liked him.
But they didn't respect him?
No, they liked him, and I think they respected him. The problem was there's a difference between respect and then having a coach that is talking to his team and creating this atmosphere where you're like, this guy's going to lead us to the promised land. I've been around different coaches, and I think with the ones, whether that's, John Fox or Pete Carroll, when they get up and they speak in front of the team, they really command everyone's ears, everyone's eyes. They command that respect. They change things up. They keep you on your toes. Those team meetings aren't wasted minutes. And I think sometimes guys who don't necessarily have that or the ability to speak in front of people and be really inspirational, I think sometimes those team meetings get wasted. Sometimes players, they don't lose respect, but they just lose like, all right, let's just get out of here. Let's get over this. This team meeting's a waste of time. Let's get to our installs. Let's get to the other things that we need to get to prepare to win. And I kind of got that feeling from talking with players and that feeling from being there. But look, I think this comes down to, and Pat, maybe you could shed some light on this. I look at his coordinators, and those are the guys that I think really, bury Joe Philbin. Is Kevin Coyle not coming up with a better defensive scheme on a week-to-week basis? Players definitely talked about that when I was there. They hated their defensive scheme with Coyle. And then on the flip side with Lazor, it was their first year, so it was a bit different. They're implementing a new system. But
now I bet they would say they hate it.
Well, what they didn't like back then, it's still true now, the pass protection.
Right.
You weren't getting pass protection then. You're not getting it now. So that's still been the same.
Pat, I wanted to ask you this. You've been around the league. You work for coaches. Is there a coach that was too nice? And you never like to say something because Joe Philbin is genuinely a nice man. Have you ever been around or worked for a coach who you looked at him and you said, I really think he's a nice guy, but that isn't going to fly in the locker room with 53 different personalities?
Well, I got a guy that was too nice and now he's not, and that's Pete. When I was with Pete at the Jets, he had two issues. Number one, he was young. Number two, he was the defensive coordinator before he was the head coach, and he communicated with the players. He had fun with them. We always had a good time with the guys. We would go bowling, all that business. When he became the head coach, he really thought then that he could still be a nice guy. And he really thought then that the players would understand now he's the head coach. But the players didn't. The defensive guys all thought of him as Pete, the guy, our friend. The offensive guys didn't know him that well. And he basically had a style that was based on mature players. And if you had any maturity in you, you could take advantage of the way things were. After he went to USC and started over again philosophically, by the time he got to Seattle, he was a hard ass. Excuse my language. He could make a tough decision. He could fire a guy that he liked that wasn't producing. That's not who he was the first time around. So I saw a guy in Pete morph from the nicest, easiest going, happy-go-lucky, perfect friend to a hard-nosed head coach.
Here's where I have a problem with the coach being, you mentioned commanding the room and everything. This is just me, and I'm sure you've been around a lot of guys like this. You probably are one like this, both of you. No, been around you a little bit. I'm a self-starter. I don't need somebody to stand in front of me and tell me, you need to do this, this, and this, and if you do that, you're going to succeed. I know what I have to do. I do it. If the guy next to me isn't doing it, that's on him, but I'm going to do my job. Am I wrong there to think that?
No, I think you're right. There's people like that out there, Pete, but I think the truth is there's been someone in your life who's inspired you. You can't say that your entire life growing up.
Who's the guy on the dollar bill? He inspires me.
At least George Washington.
See, I'm used to Benjamins.
Can you believe this guy, Pat?
Yes, I do. I think the core of rosters are full of guys like yourself, Pete, like me, same way, like Brady. But there are guys that are – there's two other types left. There's the elite athlete that never had to push himself and all of a sudden doesn't know how to push himself. Or doesn't want to, or there's the dynamic of money. The money issue, you basically just said it. But in the NFL, when you get a guy guaranteed money, and I said it every time we drafted in a first round, I said, we don't know what's going to happen to this cat when we give him cash. And that's the same thing. A lot of people turn off that, and it's not really a defensive device by you, but it's the one you have and I have. I wake up every day trying to figure out how to support my family. But when someone gives you enough money to support your family for good, or you think for good, a lot of guys let the guard down.
Yeah, and I always go back to, I'm selfish. I mean, I'm going to, first and foremost, I'm going to admit that. I'm selfish. It's about me. And if I'm a player, and I've had this argument with a lot of players before in the past, and Brady, you were a player, and Pat, you've been around him your whole life. If I do my job, so most important, what I do, if I do my job to the fullest, and I'm a great player, and the guys around me aren't great players because, A, they don't work hard enough or they can't get it done or whatever, then I'm okay with that. The team doesn't win. That isn't on me. That's on them. I did my job to the fullest.
I think there's that perspective among some players. But the problem is, Pete, that perspective only gets you so far. That's not.
What if everybody did it?
But that is the way you talk about the New England Patriots, right? And they always say that they're saying us, do your job. Do your job. They know if every individual does their job first, that'll collectively add up to the sum, and that sum will be greater than the other teams, right? But at some point, in doing your job requirement might be something where you have to play selfless, and you have to do something that sacrifices, you know, your job or maybe your stats or your production for the greater good of the team. You might have to be that wide receiver that runs down the field to clear out for whoever's coming in behind you to make the big play. Or you might have to be the guy who ends up chopping off the backside, not the guy at the front side of the play to make the block and do your job. So in that, at some point, you need that inspiration. You need someone to be able to tell you some days more than just do your job. Because we're human beings. We're not robots. We don't wake up every day and go, you know what, today I'm going to do my job. Tomorrow I'm going to do my job. There's stuff that happens in life. You have your ups and downs, maybe less so than other people. But at some point, you need that coach to be able to come in and give you something where you say, you know what? He's right, man. Today I'm doing my job, but today it's for this specific purpose. Or it's, you know, tomorrow I'm doing my job because it's for this specific purpose because, you know, it sucks. It's not the job I want to be doing. I don't want to be a blocking tight end. I think I can pass catch. I think I can run more routes. But this is what my team's asked me to do. This is how we're going to win a Super Bowl. And guess what? I know if I win a Super Bowl, I'm going to get paid more. Because everyone who wins a Super Bowl, you watch what happens to those teams. They start going off into free agency.
If you play well.
Even if you're on the team, all of a sudden you look better. Believe me.
The bottom guys.
Winning cures all illnesses.
By the way, you talk about up and down. I'm never down. I'm always up. Right, Pat? You know that. I'm always up.
You are. You're up in your own way when we have to see through the veneer. But you describe yourself to me like the perfect fullback. You will do what you have to do for the team. But you have to understand that the tailback's getting paid, not you. And if you get to X amount of dollars, they're going to cut you, even if you've been playing good. And that's the hard part for a lot of guys. And then cynicism always sets in with those guys. But there are stars on teams, and they are, as Bill Parcells would say, treated differently. And yeah, that would probably irk the living daylights out of you.
Don't make me a fullback because I want to get the cash. You know, they're getting eliminated. Don't make me a fullback, Pat. Please do not do that to me.
No, I didn't say. But you think like a fullback.
Yeah, I think like that. I think every player should think like that. Whatever your position is, whatever you have to do, just go do it and do it well. If you got to cut off, like Brady said, if you got to cut off the backside, go cut off the backside. And then you're going to get your chances to play on the front side. But when it's your chance to cut off the backside, go cut it off.
Here's the problem is Pete has never had to cut off the backside or had to be that fullback. So he doesn't understand sometimes what those crappy jobs entail or when things aren't necessarily.
Yeah, but in life, we've all had crappy jobs. In your life, at some point, you've had a job that was just awful.
I was a busser. One of those guys who brought you. I used to work at Embassy Suites when I was in high school. And I used to bring up the food, like for the room service charges and all that. And I
that could have been an interesting job. You could have seen a lot of good things.
I actually did. I did. There was a couple occasions when I opened the door and there was a chick standing there without any clothes on.
Yeah,
and I'm going, okay.
You want to hear a crappy job? I worked in the bakery at Publix once when I was in high school. They gave me a big crate of a whole cart of sheet pans that were baked goods in, and they said, "Can you clean these up by the end of the day?" I took about three of them, started scrubbing them, and I called my dad. And I said, "I'm not working here. I quit."
Oh, see, I actually held on to my job.
Pat, you've had a bad job, too.
We all had bad jobs. I had one at a nursery once, and they sent me into a hoe a field. So I was hoeing this field, getting ready to plant shrubs. And I looked across to my right, and there was a guy with a mule doing the same job, except I didn't have a mule.
And he just went and did it, right?
He did it, and the mule was happy, but I wasn't very happy. So I thought about quitting, but my old man wouldn't let me.
All right, let's get back to some football stuff. The quarterbacks being hurt, how damaging is it to the league? Because all I've heard in the last couple weeks is, boy, the play of the league isn't very good right now. How damaging is that?
I mean, first off, look at the game versus the Dallas Cowboys and New Orleans Saints.
It was a great game.
It was a great game. Went to overtime. And you're talking about a backup quarterback in Brandon Weeden who's out there doing the best he can. They don't have Dez Bryant, right? The running backs are getting banged up. It's not like he has a ton around them as far as production-wise to go to. It seems like he's doing an okay job. I don't think he gets enough credit for the crap that he's got to deal with. I mean, Tony Romo without Dez Bryant, I'd be curious to see how that whole scenario would work out. But I don't think the quarterback play is quite as bad as people want to make it out to be. I think the offensive line has been bad. I think the lack of a running game because sometimes – look, the fast way to become a coordinator, from a coordinator to become a head coach in this league, is to throw the football, put up gaudy stats, and all of a sudden you become a coordinator or you become a head coach. That's the fastest way to kind of ascend in the league, and I think too many people get so pass-happy, too many people get away from the run game and sticking with it when they should. And I think that's more of a product of that. Pat, can you –
Yeah, I have a whole – I have the same opinion based on something different. To me, it started 2 years ago, really, when we got the new CBA and we stopped practicing. It's okay for the quarterback and receivers to go out there and run skelly drills and work on routes and timing. But linemen that don't get in pads, that don't deal with pass rushers, that don't deal with blocking at the tempo called, real time, it affects how they pass protect. It affects the run blocking. Right now, the National Football League, I just looked at it a few minutes ago. The NFL, all 32 teams, are averaging under 4 yards a carry, which last year they were 4-1 a carry. Before we've been 4-2 a carry. But we have three teams that can't even average 3 yards a carry. And the sacks and the hits on the quarterback, to me, the way we practice, I remember back when our line coaches, I was with four or five of them, but Larry Bechtel mostly. Beck, all spring, those guys would be working like madmen on their stuff, and they would be in pads, and it was constant. I think the guys who play with their hand on the ground, with the way we practice today, it's really hurt their ability to produce well.
Pat, the only thing I'll say, though, to kind of rebuttal that, and I do think if there was more practice for those guys, it would help. The problem is, as a former player, that was one of the things we kind of went after in the CBA to try to get on our side was, less time practicing, less banging, that kind of stuff. Hey, I'm just telling you what was discussed.
I know.
But here's the thing. Brady, here's where I'll rebuttal it, though, Pat, is...
No, yeah. I hear you, and I understand the whole logic behind what they fought for. I wouldn't have fought for it and lost all that money, but that's another story.
Yeah. Well, but hold on for a second, because here's where I'll go to. It has not changed at the college level for as far as how much you can practice, how often you can practice, and all that. And the blocking at the college level has gotten worse. And I think it's more of actually a product of the systems that more college teams are using, the systems that more high schools are using, where it's a lot of the spread, a lot of lateral movement, then pass pro, and then really nothing else. They don't put their hand down on the ground anymore. They don't learn how to run block. They don't learn any of those skills at the college level, and even sometimes now at the high school level. And I think it's a product of that. It's a product of the lack of teaching at a fundamental level in high school and college.
And
nowadays.
The NFL.
Well, in the NFL, but I'm saying – you could take any of those guys who come from a good offense where they run the football and they're used to that in college, and you can make them into whatever you want them to be at the NFL level. It's not that easy, though, taking a spread guy, just like a quarterback, and then making a spread offensive lineman into an NFL lineman.
Isn't it amazing, though, when you really think about it? And Pat, you'll remember this because you're old like I am, but back in the day, they'd take a guy and they'd draft him. They'd say, boy, he's really good as a run blocker, but I don't know if he'll transition to the NFL and be able to pass block. Remember that?
Yes.
Now it's the opposite. Now you have no idea if he can transition to being a run blocker.
Well, it's a fact, and even the pass blocking is basically quick pass, short sets. You know, I was talking to Phil Simms the other day, and he goes, those Arizona Cardinals, man, they're still a seven-step drop team. So I cannot wait to go out there and talk to their linemen next year about that. So Brady's point's well taken. We're producing guys that can't play NFL line. Kenny Wisenhunt at the Senior Bowl last year asked the whole group on the first day, how many of you linemen have been in a three-point stance? Only like two of them. And he asked the whole team, how many of you ever been in a huddle? It was like five or six. You know, it was kind of like nuts. And so we got to work with those guys. But you take those guys, Brady, you're almost helping me with my point. You put them on NFL teams because that's the talent pool. And now you don't practice very much, and you got a bigger problem.
And you know, to your point, to both your points, they're not learning the game. There's not enough time for install like there used to be. So you take away from the fundamentals. And I mentioned this a couple weeks ago on the podcast. Tony Boselli told me when he first came into the league, they had 10 padded practices during camp a week to work on reps and getting line calls and everything else and working in unit. Now, which leads to this question. The New England Patriots have used 15 different line combinations. Is that something, because you don't have the time to work together and become a cohesive unit, is that something that we're going to see more and more of down the line?
Well, I've been a proponent of that for a long time and always been, line coaches hate when I say it, but I promise you, there were old left tackles. I'll use a guy like Lomas Brown back in his day. Lomas Brown could have played three more years if he only went in on third downs and pass blocked. He just couldn't run block anymore, and he couldn't do 9-on-7 in practice 2 days a week. But some of those guys, and so I was always in favor of a substitution situation for left tackles, and then you take your left tackle and make him the left guard or the right tackle. But we, the line coaches, would never let you think that way. But when Belichick starts doing it, which is 10,000 times more credibility than I'll ever have, all of a sudden, guys like yourself, Pete, are asking that question.
I don't like it.
Well, look, I think one thing we're overlooking, too, is after this most recent CBA, it has cut out the middle class in the NFL. And who the middle class guys are, it's a lot of times, it's not your left tackle, but it's almost everyone else on the offensive line.
Not anymore, though.
No, hold on now. Let me get there. And it's closer to those guys being more middle class when you're talking about all the other positions on the field that actually get paid. And there might be two guys on the offensive line who get paid really well, but the rest of the guys aren't getting that same amount. Those top 3-5 guys on every team that get paid that top dollar value, it's usually your left tackle. You can maybe say you're right. Few centers. And guards, even harder to come by. So the problem is, one, we're talking about the New England Patriots who mixed in 15 different combinations, right? Well, you got to have depth, and you got to have guys behind them who are actually experienced, knowledgeable, and can actually fundamentally block the technique you want. Those guys used to be older players. That's not happening anymore.
Well, they're
that's
playing three rookies now.
Exactly. And that's you're making my point, Pete. That's a product of the most recent
CBA. Okay, yeah, I'll give you that. It's also a product of the development of the backup line, and I go back to what LaCharles.
You don't have those veteran guys.
Well, here's,
anymore,
what, here's
that's what I'm saying.
That's why the drop off.
It's a lack of development.
Do you agree with
this? Lack of
that,
average life.
Because this sounded. LaCharles Bentley told me this. He said the drop off between the backups and the starters to the backups in the NFL is the biggest drop off in any the offensive line. The drop off of any position in all of sports. In other words. From quarterback to quarterback, from pitcher to pitcher, from goalie to goalie. Would you agree with that, Pat?
I would never. The drop-off's significant, and a lot of line coaches complain that linemen number 6, 7, and 8 are inexperienced in many places because they can't afford with the cap to have experienced guys. But I think the drop-off at quarterback is the most severe, and I'll just cite the backups. Look at the backups who started. As I said earlier today, they're 1 win, 5 losses, and I would think they're going to lose 2 or 3 more this weekend. So that, to me, is the biggest drop-off. But the linemen, it's a good point. I got to ask Brady this question, though. Brady, after listening to you and listening to the two of us, I'm inclined to ask you, if you were running a draft room, would you draft a quarterback or a lineman from a spread offense that was in a two-point stance – and just ran that's the Baylor stuff. Would you be inclined to take those guys anywhere in the first 4 rounds?
No. I mean, I think the transition for both is so hard. And even for wide receivers. You know, Josh Dotson, for example, I did a TCU game the other week, Pat. He caught 18 balls, had like 270 yards, I think 2 or 3 touchdowns. It was a ridiculous performance. The problem was he ran like 5 routes. He ran a slant. He ran an in route. In the field and in the red zone, a go ball, I think a post, and a stop route. That's all he ran. And that's all they really require him to run. He never has to cross the field. He doesn't really go in motion. He just stays on one side of the field. And that's to the extent of which he has to know. He doesn't hear a play call in the huddle. He doesn't hear a formation that he has to adjust to which side of the field he's on. And it actually makes him think. His routes aren't even necessarily indicative of what coverage are they playing. Do I have to adjust my route like you have to do in the NFL? The spread offense is hurting so many players, not just an offensive lineman or a quarterback. So I would be very, very hesitant to really utilize any of those players. And actually, the one player where I think I would give more benefit to than anyone else is the running back. And the reason why is because they're good catching the ball out of the backfield, whether that's in the screens or running routes. They actually have to be a part in the pass protection. So they learn how to pick up guys and see different blitzers coming, even though it may be simple. So you're able to identify if they can do that. And on a lot of those different run plays, I think it's harder to run out of shotgun than it is when your quarterback's under center. So if you can run, you know, being in a spread, I think he's definitely going to be able to run if he's a quarterback under center.
You know, this brings me to something else that I'll give credit where credit is due, but it's something that's always bothered me in the last couple of years is the play of the free safety position, and with everything, it kind of goes back to the college game. Everything is so spread out now. And Daniel Jeremiah made a good point. Everybody's focused on the kickers. If you took a real look at yesterday's games and watched the free safeties and the strong safeties when they're playing deep and looked at their pursuit angles and how they come after the ball in the passing game, that's why a guy like Devin McCourty and guys like that, why Earl Thomas is so valuable in Seattle. Pat, where the hell are all the free safeties in the National Football League?
Well, I think a lot of guys have, they play coverages in college all the time that they don't really have a deep center fielder that can do what Errol does. They're hard to find. And Pete was criticized for taking Chancellor over his own player at SC, but he thought the range was better. To me, everyone's looking for matchup players because Brady can go on. Brady can shift his offensive formation in a way to get every one of those defensive backs singled up. He knows how to do it. He can flex his tight end one side. He can now put the back and go to an empty set and get that free safety on another guy. So people have figured out how to isolate him. Consequently, I think you see a lot more cornerback transitions into the safety spot. I'm going to start looking at those this week. How many guys really came into this league as a corner and now playing free safety?
Well, I mean, you look at Buffalo. Buffalo has 4 safeties on the field in their starting secondary. I mean, 4 corners on the field in their starting secondary. The 2 safeties were both moved inside. They're former corners. And I think that's something we're going to see more and more of. The problem is, as you know, will that safety come up and tackle in the hole?
Yeah, well one, there's a reason why more teams are trying to put guys who have corner experience or covering experience on the field. A number of reasons. One, you don't have to substitute, right? Because offenses are starting to play at a faster pace. They're trying to limit your opportunity to substitute. So you'd rather err on the side of, we've got guys who can cover and we can play man-to-man and just rush and play a basic call if indeed they catch us and try to play fast pace. So that's one of the reasons. The other reason, and I was just talking to Pete about this, Pat, you know, again, it's the spread game effect. Because of the spread game, now it forces college defenses to not play as much man-to-man because they're worried about those guys being out there on islands and getting beat and then all of a sudden being torched the entire day on defense. So what do? They play a soft cover four, or they play that quarter-quarter half coverage where those free safeties now are essentially playing half the field, or they're playing the field or boundary, and that's how their call is made. And they're not necessarily made to be able to read a quarterback and sit in the middle of the field and take better angles. So it even has an effect on the defense and how simplified some of the defensive calls have been made and all that when you're trying to evaluate talent. But I think at some point, we got to realize that free safeties, besides probably Earl Thomas, which ones do you know that really are paid that much? Like, if I'm
McCourty got paid last year, and Weddle will probably get paid next year, and Harrison Smith, if he could get paid.
At some point.
Harrison Smith would get paid.
Harrison's, yeah, but he's not a free to me. Harrison,
see, he is a free, but
he's different. I mean, he's able to do both. But it's another position where I think it's kind of gotten devalued with the way we look at it.
Oh, I think it's more valued. That's why I think Seattle is what they are, is because Earl Thomas can do all that
stuff.
Well,
look, Cam Chancellor was gone, and Earl Thomas was still playing. They didn't look like the same secondary, did they, Pete?
Well, but the other corner is also gone, too.
I'm just saying. They didn't
Earl
like
Thomas
the
is the guy that's the straw that stirs that drink.
You can say that, but
let me
tell you
jump
what.
In here, because 11 personnel, three wides, one tight, one running back, has been, for the last 3 years, the most dominating personnel group used in the NFL. This is going right to Brady's point. When I'm an 11 personnel team, and I'll give you some numbers just based off the first 3 weeks. Chicago, 70% 11 personnel. Green Bay, 78% 11 personnel. Indianapolis, 75%. Miami, 88%. 86% in Philly. 86% in San Diego. What's the point? Okay, I know you're 11 personnel most of the time, but I got to deal with first and 10. That's why I don't want to bring in nickel, because these guys will run against that. So you want to go out there in your base defense. Uh-oh, they're an 11. Yeah, I know. Okay, we'll go out in base. The free safety on half your calls has got to take the slot receiver. He has to take the third guy. That's what's going to happen now. So on the first down calls, the free safety is playing man-to-man on a slot corner, on a slot wideout. And then if you go out there and nickel, they're going to run against you. So you have these dilemmas against 11 personnel that made the free safety basically a hybrid player. He's got to be half corner, half you know, safety.
Well, and that goes to what I was going to bring up next is there's a guy in Arizona named Honey Badger, Tyrann Mathieu. Is he the guy, that type
yes.
of player that everybody's going to try and fit into now moving forward? He's a hybrid safety. He can play, line up in the slot. He can blitz. He can tackle. Is that the next X factor guy in the National Football League? That kind of player.
Well, you're already seeing it at the college level, who that player is. And LSU, he was that player at LSU. But because of the spread style game, who you're seeing are guys like Denzel Johnson for TCU, or KJ Dillon for West Virginia, or Stephen Parker for Oklahoma. They're basically that nickel guy that's not nickel size. He's a safety size, but he's got the coverage skills to be able to play in the box and cover anyone downfield on early downs like Pat's talking about, or come up and stop the run. And that's what's happening now. And you could ask any defensive-minded college coach who has to defend against the spread, they'll tell you, that guy's the most important guy on my defense. Last year for TCU, why were they so successful? They had a guy named Sam Carter, who was a former high school quarterback, who then changed and adapted to the style, and he had a huge impact on TCU and how successful they were in their defense.
But there's so much spread in college. Does this now translate to the NFL?
It translates because of what Pat's talking about. Look, spread is a very vague term. To me, all you're talking about in the spread is you're spreading the field. You're using 11 personnel, which is what Pat's saying.
Right.
And how you implement the passing routes and the strategy and all that, That's different. That's on each coordinator and each guy and how they do it. That's why there's this whole air raid is what it used to be. But even those guys who broke off from those systems in college, they don't run it, and you haven't seen as much in the NFL. But that position's become so important because of the personnel like Pat's talking about and because of the skill set that they possess. So I think it's definitely going to bleed over to the NFL for sure.
And then, Pat, but the the flip side of that is you saw what happened to that Arizona defense that plays that style with the extra defensive back on the field all the time when Gurley ran through him yesterday.
Well, you can't have your cake and eat it too.
Wants that. We all want that.
The offense started this great battle of hybrids, right? They all found basketball players to play tight end. Uh-oh, they flex him out. He's a wide out. They bring him in. He's a okay, adequate blocker. They all found the Reggie Bush guy who can empty out the backfield. Brady can empty him out. Now we got a real receiver out there. So you had the defense was not into the hybrid world. The defense was into substitution world where they decided, okay, well, you got two hybrid guys, a back and a tight end. Okay, that's a problem. So we're just going to play you by down and distance. And then they started getting beat up. I mean, Belichick did it to everybody with Hernandez and Gronk and all that business. Along comes the Levante David hybrid safety slash linebacker, the guy who can walk out on the slot and have the skills to play him. And it's not always – Brady would probably say, every time I see the wheel, I know you're in zone. But no, the hybrid guy who's that guy, Thomas Davis is one of them, and then the hybrid safety who has corner skills. If you don't have two guys that can overlap in the hybrid defensive world, the offense is going to get you every time.
Here's the other reason, Pat, why it's so important. When you've got quarterbacks who can run, the defense now has to prepare to attack an extra gap, as they call it. They have to account for it because they have to account for the quarterback getting outside the pocket. And what that does is it forces you defensively to say, all right, we've got to have another guy responsible in the run game. So now they're able to load up the box more, play man-to-man coverage. So that hybrid guy has to be able to cover. In part, a little bit, because some of these teams do have more of the capabilities of running at the quarterback position.
Is this why, right now, as we sit here, it's really hard to identify a dominant defense? I mean, think about it. Seattle's been dominant. I mean, they've been arguably one of the greatest defenses we've seen the last couple of years. But take them out of the equation, Pat. The Pittsburgh used to be a dominant defense, not anymore. Baltimore used to be a dominant defense, not anymore. Kansas City has those pass rushers. They're not a dominant defense. Where are the dominant defenses?
Well, there's one in Denver, and I'll say it is because Von Miller and DeMarcus Ware can play the run, and they're tremendous pass rushers, and they have two corners that can match up. So if Brady Quinn is playing against a defense that has matchup corners on it, and Belichick used to call them jokers, right? Brewski and all these guys that could play the run but also rush the passer, Vrabel. You know, they're not jokers in Denver. They're you know what they are. But they can be dominating on defense because they have those qualities. And if you don't have those, not everyone's playing man, but you better be able to take Odell Beckham out if you want to beat the Giants. You got to neutralize the guy.
Yeah,
and if you don't have the corners and you don't have those hybrid guys inside that can rush and play the run, because I think the day of jogging the 250-pound pass rusher out for every third down, so what? I mean, can he stay out there so I can do things exotically on other downs?
Yeah, Pat, I don't necessarily have this stat in front of me, but I'd be guaranteed if you brought up the stat of how many teams pass now on first down versus run, it's taken a dramatic shift over the past 10 years. And I think it's in part, we don't see as many good defenses because, defenses are still trying to kind of adapt to the changing times of the offenses and how much more wide open they're getting, how much more they're throwing the football as opposed to running the football. And to me, I think it's harder and harder to find that nose for like a 3-4 scheme. You just don't see it anymore. And teams who are 3-4, they have to go to a 4-down front. Anytime they're playing against the sub personnel, that's the only way they're able to really be effective. So I think it's a lot of defensive coaches having to change the way they look at implementing some of their defensive strategies, being able to stop the run from those 11 personnel sets, but also just find the bodies. Find a guy who's able to play that nose guard who's going to be that effective in the NFL, but can still be a zero technique and a 3-4 as well. It's hard to find those guys.
Yeah, I'll throw one piece on top of this. when I was charting defenses just 10 years ago, you didn't see really anyone but maybe Belichick occasionally play three safety defense, big nickel we call it. You didn't see it. Big nickel's all over the place. You guys keep citing Arizona. They play big nickel. They like playing three safeties. A lot of teams do it, but I'm looking at a blitz chart. To your point, Brady, who's blitzing on first downs? Because that calls to the old balance of 50-50 run pass. Well, if I see you blitzing on first down, you know, you're seeing other things when you're getting ready. So the Jets, 40% blitz on first down. 49ers, 47% blitz. The Arizona Cardinals, 46% blitz on first downs.
That's pretty amazing. You know, I said this 10 years ago to a couple coaches once. Tell me if this is where I think it went. I said, the big corner will soon move inside and become the free safety. The free safety will move over and become the strong safety. The strong safety will get a couple 15 pounds heavier and become the weak side linebacker. The weak side linebacker will get a couple pounds heavier and become the strong side linebacker. The strong side linebacker will get 15 pounds heavier and put his hand on the ground and become the defensive end, and so on and so on, because the game, the way the game is played. Hasn't that played true?
It's interesting, because I mean, if you think about it, right, the way the game's got, players are getting bigger, faster, stronger, right?
Right.
But you're talking about basically guys who played other positions are now moving into those bigger positions, even though they don't have the same type of size.
And when you go to like nickel rushes in some situations, you might not have somebody who's bigger than 260 pounds on the field.
Yeah, it's weird. And it's funny because everyone wants those taller, long arm, long legged cornerbacks to be able to cover on the outside because they feel it gives a harder window to throw into. The problem is, as more and more teams start to run more and more plays in any given game and pick up the tempo of their offense to put more pressure on the defense, those guys can't last. They don't have the same type of endurance as that 5'10 cornerback who only weighs 180 pounds versus the 6'1 guy who weighs 205 pounds. So it's interesting to see how, you know, things are still adjusting, things are still changing.
Pat, Mike Zimmer told me he thinks because of the way that has happened and way that has evolved that we're coming back to the running game again. You believe him?
I totally agree with Mike. Now, not everyone will do it, but if you keep looking at undersized defenses that are built, you know, when you look at the 11 guys, whether it was our conversation about hybrid backers or hybrid corners that became, what you're looking at is faster defenses built to stop the passing game. And if they're built to stop the passing game, like I can tell you, Pete's philosophy with Marshawn Lynch, it's obvious to the world, they like running on undersized defenses. Not many coaches will stick with it, though. So the guys that want to get good at that part of it, there's going to be increasing advantages to having a good power run game.
Pete's got to run Marshawn Lynch. He's got quarterback limitations.
Oh gosh, no! You know why? You know why they're so effective? You know what? If you put me in that system, they're not going to run the ball quite as well. In particular, because I'm not as good of a quarterback as Russell Wilson. But
that's debatable, by the way.
But because I can't run as effective as he can, and they don't have to account for me as much in the zone read scheme as they do Russell Wilson.
I understand. I'm kidding around.
No, but your other point, Pete, that you made about defense and your vision for how it was going to go. Big corner to safety, et cetera, all the way down the line. Think about offense. It's done the same thing. Most of the left tackles were college tight ends, and they certainly almost all were high school tight ends. And the big tackle that was the high school senior, he's playing guard, and the high school guard ain't getting recruited. It's basically what's happened.
Hey, Pete, didn't you play guard in high school?
I did. But, you know, it's. I'm glad you mentioned that that is one of the actual – scouting things that I got right over the years is when Jason Peters was coming out of Arkansas, I said, make that kid a left tackle. Remember, Patty was a tight end.
Yep.
And they made him a tackle, and he's one of the better tackles in the league, even though Chip can't get his offensive line to work in Philadelphia. Why did you chuckle when you said I was a guard? Come on.
Well, I'm just saying, man.
I was a mean, nasty, feisty little guy.
Yeah, you talk about that all the time. Hey, real quick before we finish up, I've got a pet peeve, Pat, and I'm curious to get your and Pete's take on this. You know, we've been seeing, like, we saw a divisional game played in London this past week. We see these Thursday night games, a short week for both teams, divisional games. As a player, I'm like, man, so much, the division matters so much in these rivalries and these matchups. I don't like it that it's like an outlier when you have to go to London or a short week on Thursday night. It's too tough, and I think it not only is it tough in a divisional game if you're the road team, it's really tough on a short week or really tough when you have to fly overseas to London. I just don't like the scheduling of it because that's too big of an impact. I'd rather it be a little bit more level field, normal week. You know, road team, you know, obviously still is at the disadvantage of the home team, but just not with that much ramifications on the line on a short week.
I'm with you. I don't know so much about the London thing because both guys are screwed with that one, but the divisional Thursday night games is a disaster. And the visiting teams have not fared well so far this year. Now, they did okay last year, but I'm with you. The statistic they never give us is they always tell, oh, not as many. The injuries are the same on Thursday as Sunday. Well, great. But how many guys couldn't even play on Thursday because exactly. They weren't able to recover? So I do not like – I mean, look at this one coming up. Houston's a mess. Houston's got to get on a plane and come to the Colts. Is that what they're doing?
No, it's the other way around.
My apologies, but it's just as bad that way.
Yeah, but for every yin, there's a yang. You know, we talk about how bad the play is on Thursday night and how tough it is to make the turnaround, but then you have 10 days off before you play your next Sunday game. So then make that the divisional game, Brady. Yeah, I'm with you on that.
Thursday, why wouldn't you have the bye the week before your Thursday game?
Yeah,
right. I'm with you on the divisional games. I think they kind of cheat the fans when you play them on a Thursday night too. Because every fan who's ever rooted for a team in a division, if you're the Giant fan, you want to see the Cowboys game. You don't want to see it on a Thursday night. If you're a Cowboys fan and you play the Redskins, you don't want to see it on a Thursday night. If you're the Steelers and Ravens, they played on a Thursday night. I'm with you. You could have a whole bunch of other games to pick from. The problem is Thursday night, CBS night, they want marquee teams and marquee games.
No, I get that. But look, I mean, if you're a diehard fan too, you're not traveling on a Thursday night to go to that game if you're the part of the away team. On a weekend, you could still make the trip and still be part of the experience, part of the game, part of the rivalry, right? Because, you know, usually you're within that region. It's,
right.
The travel's not as bad.
Right.
You can't do it on Thursday night. So I'm just saying from a player's perspective.
They just wanted to build Thursday night into a must-see TV night, and they are in the process of doing it.
Yeah, but it's going to be anyways. Yeah, it's Thursday night football.
But here's the other thing about the play. Every Thursday night, the game starts, and everybody goes, oh, these Thursday night games, the play isn't that good. The problem is it's one game everybody's watching. When you watch on Sunday, and we have the green room in here, we watch them all. Pat, you do it up there on CBS. There's probably seven games where the play is atrocious. But most people aren't watching focused on just one game, so they don't see it all. So I think that magnifies the fact that the play isn't as good on Thursday night.
Well, my pet peeve to build off your opinion there, Brady, is I absolutely don't think we should ever play Thursday night football without at least 50 active players. It's a joke. How many guys, you don't know if they can play. They'll tell, I think I can go, coach. Well, five plays into it, they can't go. You need 50 on Thursday nights.
I agree. That's the dumbest rule the NFL has.
That's a great rule, Pat. I mean, yeah, to have such a small roster in the first place with 53 guys and then not have all of them active for any given game.
What's the point of not having them all active?
I have no idea.
What's the rationale?
It's a dumb rule.
Have you ever figured that one out, Pat?
Yeah, I was in the meetings.
Maybe one team will have an advantage if they're healthy.
And their whole logic was, well, we don't want an unlevel playing field where you have 50 active and we have 48. So I posed that question to six owners, and Bob McNair had it best. He said, look, I'm already paying 53 guys, and I'm paying 8 or 10 guys on my practice squad. So this week I only have 45 healthy guys. Good. Bring up 5 from the practice squad. We were going to bring up 1 or 2 anyway. But let's put everyone we're paying on the field, and 50 was the number that he thought. He said, I'd vote for that right now. And so did the other 5 owners. And I'll name Stephen Jones was one of those owners who said that to me. The owner of the Kansas City Chiefs said it. The owner of the 49ers said it. This idea that we would surrender a level playing field because it'd be uneven numbers of players is nonsense. We're going to have 10 on the practice squad. You dip in your squad if you have to. Get to 50. So when your left tackle has a blown-out hamstring, he doesn't go back in the game because there's no lineman left.
Before we get out of here, that brings me to another kind of transition to this. Does the NFL need a minor league the way college football is being played today to develop its talent?
I think
they're
going
to have one this year, I can tell you that. They're pretty much down the road with setting it up. And they're going to, I think, to my knowledge, they've already started to hire the coaches and GMs. And they are going to launch it in the United States.
Is that the FXFL?
No, it's I won't call it an NFL product, but it's all NFL people are going to be involved in it.
Yeah, but Pat, is it going to be where two or three teams have a feeder from one team so they can have, you know, in other words, if you're, you have a feeder program, kind of like the NBDL is with the NBA
yes,
now.
Yes, to my knowledge, and I've been privileged with some conversations, not all of them, it will be regionalized by NFL teams in the area.
Well, and they're hiring people already.
Yes, to my knowledge, most of the coaches.
I haven't got the call yet to be the GM yet. Would you tell those people that I'm interested?
Well, I know I can get you the job as the left guard. I'm not sure about the
GM. Hey, the way the backup linemen play in this league, I can't imagine what they'll be like in that league, right?
Well, you know what? I would not doubt that you could run block the living. Brady, you know that Pete could trap block somebody and just knock him out.
He could trap block someone, but that's only one play.
I wouldn't want to trap block Vince Wilfork's stomach. Have you seen it lately?
Did you see him bounce on top of the back glass yesterday?
He's gonna. Hey, by the way, Pat. By the end of the year, he's gonna be 400. If you weigh him by December, he will be 400 pounds.
I would bet if you weighed him by the end of today.
All right. With that, we're gonna wrap it up. Hey, Pat. Every Monday, man. Make sure we're all gonna be here together. This is fun. It was a good time.
Oh, awesome.
All right, thanks, there you go. Roughing the Passer podcast.